Call the meeting to order, Commerce and Consumer Protection, Finance and Policy for April 9th. We do not have a quorum yet, so we will not be moving the minutes. On our agenda today, we will be hearing first from Delta Airlines. This is an informational overview and update. And if the testifiers would like, they can come to the table if they're prepared. Mr. Lynch? And Mr. Davidman. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. And if you could just introduce yourselves for the record and present. Thank you very much for being here today. As you know, I represent Egan. I'm sure there's other members of the committee who have a lot of Delta employees in their district, but I know when I've been door-to-door in my district, you all have a big impact in my community, so I look forward to hearing what you have to say.
Thank you. Well, Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for having us. My name is Bill Lynch. I'm the Senior Vice President of Minnesota Operations for Delta Airlines. Been with the airline for 24 years, started originally with Northwest in 1989 and now with Delta. And joining me here is Jeff Davidman, who works with me on government affairs here in Minnesota and across other parts of the country. The thought today is to provide you an update on how things are going with Delta Airlines, where we stand in the state of Minnesota since it has now been 4.5 years when the merger was approved. And I want to walk you through the Delta footprint. I want to talk to you a little bit about some of the investments, where we are with operations, and then certainly willing to take questions. And if there are questions along the way, I will have some slides up here. If there are questions along the way, please feel free to stop me. I won't be going through all of the material on these slides. You've got the packages that you can take with you. But very willing to answer any questions that you have. So we'll go to the first page. And this is the general overview of what we call Delta by the numbers in the state of Minnesota. And I'll walk through some of these numbers for you. First of all, if you look at our summer schedule this coming summer, and the way we look at the size of the schedule is we look at the peak day operations in the middle of the summer, which is typically midweek in July. We have 477 scheduled departures in our operation this summer. That compares to exactly the same number that we had last year. So year over year, the number of operations is relatively flat. And to give you some idea of where this stands compared to where Delta was at its very peak in summer operations, when we were flying our highest volumes, we were at about 500 departures. That was several years ago. So over the course of the last several years, we've remained relatively constant in our number of departures out of Minneapolis-St. Paul in the summertime, even though the airline industry has had a fair amount of contraction over the last several years as a result of the economic downturn. So we're very comfortable with the level of flying. We have 142 nonstop destinations out of Minneapolis-St. Paul. You can see the bullet below, 22 of those are international destinations, which means the other 120 are domestic destinations. Delta remains very committed to the community. We are partnered with more than 60 organizations across Minneapolis-St. Paul and really across the state of Minnesota. The number really is closer to 80, 60 plus, because we have some ins and outs depending upon the time of the year, but we partner very closely with nonprofit, business, civic organizations to maintain a presence outside just the airport area here in the Twin Cities. As measured by seat departures, we are Delta's second largest hub behind Atlanta. Seat departures is just simply the number of seats that depart from our airport on a daily basis. Other airports, Detroit for example, may have more departures, but a larger concentration of smaller airplanes in Detroit, more regional flying in Detroit. Minneapolis has a nice balance of regional and mainline, as we call it, the bigger airplanes. And so we depart more seats and therefore more passengers on a daily basis out of Minneapolis-St. Paul than what we see in Detroit. So Atlanta's first, Minneapolis is second, Detroit third, JFK fourth, LaGuardia fifth as measured by seat departures. Number of jobs in the state of Minnesota, if you look purely at the mainline, and when we talk about mainline, when I talk about mainline, it is really just the Delta big jet operation. We have 9,700 employees in the state of Minnesota. When you add to that our affiliates and our wholly owned subsidiaries, the number climbs to more than 12,000. And just to give you some sense, that number has been very steady. In fact, when we move the Pinnacle headquarters to the Twin Cities here, and that's going to happen in the next 6 to 7 weeks, the number will drive up to about 12,400 jobs, and that will be up slightly compared to where we were a couple of years ago. So our level of employment in the state of Minnesota is very steady. And then finally, again, along the lines of community involvement, we have 19 different boards across the state of Minnesota where we have Delta leaders representing Delta on those boards. And one note I will make here is this isn't just leaders who reside in Minnesota. We have leaders from Atlanta who come up as well to participate on some of our local boards, nonprofit boards, business community boards. Okay. We turn to page 3, talk a little bit about our footprint in the state of Minnesota, and I won't go through all of this in detail. This is a map of the state of Minnesota, which is identifying several locations where we have operations across the state. Of course, we have the Twin Cities with a whole host of different operations that we run in the Twin Cities, but we continue to provide service to many of the greater Minnesota communities, as you can see by some of the indicators that we have on the map here. So I'll give you an opportunity to just take a look at that a little bit, and then we'll move on. Okay. And since it's a relatively new development and soon to happen, we thought we would put a page in here which focuses on the Pinnacle headquarters. As you may know, Pinnacle is currently in bankruptcy and is set to emerge from bankruptcy in early May, by early May. The hearing for their bankruptcy emergence is set for the 17th of April. When they emerge from bankruptcy, Pinnacle will become a wholly owned subsidiary of Delta Airlines. We have worked out a deal with the state of Minnesota, with the MAC, and Delta. It was a very good partnership among those organizations. We worked out a deal that made it very attractive for Pinnacle to move their headquarters from Memphis to Minneapolis-St. Paul. They will reside in a facility at the airport that is currently available for their employees. So by the end of May, we anticipate that headquarters move will be complete. The first organization to move up from Memphis is their Operations Control Center. I had an opportunity to tour the facility where this organization is going to reside. I toured last week just to see how the building renovation is going. And it looks as though we're on schedule for the Pinnacle Systems Operation Control Center, their Operations Control Center. This is the organization that kind of quarterbacks the operation day-to-day, to be moved in the first week of May. So we're 3 to 4 weeks away from the first group of Pinnacle employees moving up from Memphis. Pinnacle currently has 1,100 employees. So this is independent of the headquarters move. Currently has 1,100 employees who are based in Minnesota. The headquarters is going to bring anywhere from 2 to 350 new jobs to the state of Minnesota. And we can't be precise there yet because Pinnacle is still going through some of the restructuring as part of their bankruptcy process. So in the end, it's going to be somewhere in the 200 to 350 range. In addition to that, as a result of Pinnacle's restructuring and the way they plan to utilize some of their crew members, there will be more pilots and flight attendants who will be hired and based in Minnesota, or will be based in Minnesota. Some hiring and some will be pilots moving from other bases. So we not only expect to see the headquarters staff of 200 to 350, but we anticipate some crew member growth in the state of Minnesota as well. And you can see the last bullet there will give you an idea of the functions that are coming as part of the headquarters move. This is their executive leadership, their operations leadership, their human resources, their finance organization. It will be a fully functioning headquarters facility. Next page. We always like maps in the airline industry, so this is a map of the U.S. to show you where we fly nonstop out of Minneapolis-St. Paul. The red dots indicate major business centers where we operate nonstop service, and then the blue dots give you an idea of the other locations where we fly nonstop. And you can see where we have the major business markets identified. You can see the frequency, the number of daily trips that we provide to those destinations. Chicago, for example, very popular out of Minneapolis-St. Paul, 16 round trips a day to Chicago, 11 to Atlanta, 9 to Detroit. We provide 15 to New York. We provide very good frequency to some of the key business markets out of Minneapolis-St. Paul, which really makes this airport valuable to the business community here, not only in the Twin Cities, but around the region. This next page provides you an overview of where we provide international service. We do provide nonstop service, as indicated by the darker blue. I know it may be a little bit hard to pick that out of the slide, but the darker blue dots indicate where we provide nonstop service out of Minneapolis-St. Paul. The light blue is our indicates destinations where we can get our customers with connecting service. And what we'd like to point out here is that either nonstop or with one stop, we can get to the 10 national export markets, the top 10 national export markets out of the state of Minnesota, with either nonstop service or one stop service. So we provide very, very valuable service to our key international export markets. This next slide, I know it has a lot of text on it. I'm going to try to really condense this down into a simple message, and it's focused on the graph that has the dark blue and the light blue bars. If you look at the darker blue bars, that bar represents the metropolitan statistical area, or the population of that metropolitan center. And that corresponds to the left y-axis. So in Minneapolis-St. Paul, 3 to 3.5 million residents in the metropolitan area. And you can see the cities that we've lined up here that are slightly larger and slightly smaller in MSA population. The light blue bars correspond to the right y-axis. The light blue bar indicates the number of nonstop destinations that the airport serving that MSA population flies to. So for Minneapolis-St. Paul, we have 152 nonstop destinations for roughly 3 to 3.5 million residents in our community. If you compare that to those metropolitan areas slightly larger and slightly less, the message here is that we provide a very good level of service for the size of this community. And that would not happen without a hub being here. Very candidly, that wouldn't happen without a hub being here, because the origin traffic, those who start their journey out of Minneapolis-St. Paul, is not large enough to command or demand 152 nonstop destinations. But by bringing customers from other airports around the country, around the world, connecting them in Minneapolis-St. Paul, and then moving them on to their final destination, we now have enough travelers here in Minneapolis-St. Paul who want to go to 152 nonstop destinations out of Minneapolis-St. Paul. So by virtue of having the hub and being able to connect to 152 destinations out of Minneapolis-St. Paul, makes this an incredibly efficient airport for not only our local travelers, but for those who want to connect through Minneapolis-St. Paul. So you can see we fare very well. You have to go all the way to the left to Dallas to find a city of larger size that has more nonstop destinations than Minneapolis-St. Paul. We feel very good about the level of service that we provide for our size. Okay. The next page very quickly gives you a list of the top 20 destinations out of the Twin Cities and our frequency. So you've seen some of these numbers on the map a couple of pages prior. Just thought I'd give you a listing of a combination of both domestic destinations and international destinations, the number of seats that we operate to those destinations, and the frequency, which is the number of trips we make on a daily basis. So we cover not only some good domestic frequency and volume, but also international frequency and volume. Now I'd like to talk a little bit about the investments that we've been making in the airport, and hopefully if you've used the airport recently, you've been able to see these in various ways. We've invested more than $30 million in the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport over the last couple of years. The lobby, we've redesigned the lobby to improve the flow of our customers through the lobby. repositioned kiosk, rolled out new technology in the lobby. We've been able to separate processes to make the throughput or the line wait time at the Delta counters much quicker. We've been able to take 3 to 5 minutes off of the customer's travel experience through the lobby in Minneapolis-St. Paul through some of these investments. We invested over $2 million in our Sky Club on the F&G concourse, which is right near Chili's. In fact, that is the highest revenue generating Sky Club in the entire Delta system. So it's really the crown jewel of the Delta Sky Club system. We have partnered with OTG, which is a concession management company based out east, to completely renovate the G concourse. We have rolled out a new restaurant concepts on the G concourse, which take menus, ingredients, ideas, service ideas from local chefs and roll them out into the airport. So we have pulled away a little bit from the national international franchise concept, and what we have designed along with a dozen local chefs is an offering on the G concourse that gives our customers, whether they originate here or connect here, a taste of Minnesota along the G concourse. On top of that, what we have done is we've rolled out technology that makes the experience there puts much more control in the hands of the customer. So there are 2,500 iPads, which we believe is the largest public deployment of iPads, positioned throughout the concourse that allow customers to order food, order beverage, order retail, maintain a status on their flight, essentially give them all the information and all the service that they need, with the exception of the delivery of the final product, right there in their hands. So OTG has been a very good partner with us there. We've invested in our control center, or our tower in Minneapolis, that allows us to improve communication and manage operational tactical decisions much better. And then we are now we have come to an agreement with the Metropolitan Airports Commission staff on a redesign of the International Arrivals Facility in Minneapolis. We see this as the last opportunity to really improve our customer service and experience in the airport. So we are going to be expanding the International Arrivals Facility to provide bigger baggage carousels so that bags don't pile up on one another when we have multiple arriving flights at the same time, and to provide a better experience, a less cramped experience, quite frankly, for our customers in the Customs and Border Protection primary screening area out there. So we're going to enlarge the space in the International Arrivals Facility. That's roughly a $13 million investment that will be completed by the spring of 2014. We're not only investing in facilities, we're investing in our people, and we're very proud of this. We have a program called Shared Rewards. We have three key measures, and I'll show those to you in a page here. We have three key measures that really identify the level of excellence in our operations. Those are: how often do we arrive on time within 14 minutes of schedule at our destination? How many mishandled bags, or how few mishandled bags, do we have? And how often do we complete a flight, i.e. not cancel a flight, that we have scheduled? And when we hit all three of those goals in a month, employees who are eligible for the Shared Rewards program get paid $100. Last year, in 2012, all 12 months, we hit all three goals, and so all employees eligible in the program received an incremental $1,200 of pay last year as a result of their excellent operational performance. We continue that streak, by the way, in 2013. We hit all three goals in January, and we're waiting for final numbers in February. Profit sharing. When we have a profitable year, we want to share that some of that profitability with our employees. Last year, 2012, we achieved about $1.6 billion in pre-tax profit, and as a result of that, we shared nearly $400 million of that with our employees. And we do that every Valentine's Day. The 14th of February is targeted to be profit sharing day at Delta Airlines. In the last 3 years now, we have provided profit sharing checks to our employees. Again, this past year, in total, roughly $400 million of profit sharing. On an annual basis, we send out a survey to our employees, and that may not sound like a big deal, but we take this very seriously. We solicit from our employees feedback. We ask them 30 different questions. We give them an opportunity to provide us some free-form text feedback, and we ask for what it is that we can do to make your operation, to make your company better. And we take that feedback very seriously. I review it with my team, but then I report up through my leadership all the way to the board of directors on a quarterly basis. What is it that we heard from our employees, and what is it that we are doing to fix it? And this is given a high level of priority across all levels of leadership. And then a few other things that we've done in Minneapolis. We constructed a fitness center for our employees. We invested $2 million in a fitness center, which we provide a large subsidy to. It's not completely funded by employee contributions. It's a very nominal amount of employee monthly due, and then the company subsidizes the remainder to give our employees an opportunity during their break, before or after work, to go get in a workout on our property, make it very convenient for them. We've renovated cafeterias and break rooms, so we're really working hard to invest in and improve the experience for our employees at the airport. We talk a little bit about performance. These charts, these are the three measures that I indicated earlier that our employees keep a sharp focus on when it comes to the shared rewards program. Completion factor, that is a measure of the number of flights that is completed versus the number of flights that is scheduled. So 100%, of course, is good. That means you've completed every flight. Last year in 2012, we completed 99.5% of all of our scheduled flights. This includes cancellations for weather, cancellations for mechanical reasons, etc. So we canceled less than a percent, about 0.5% of our flights, which was number one among carriers in our industry. We were number one in arrival within 14 minutes last year at 86.6% of all flights that we operated made their destination within 14 minutes of schedule. You can see where we had performed in prior years, and you can see what kind of improvement we've made into 2012. And then finally, in the upper right-hand corner, mishandled baggage ratio. This is the number of mishandled bags for every 1,000 customers that fly on our airplanes. In 2007, we mishandled 6.5 bags. In 2012, we're down to 2.1.
Looks like we have a question. Representative Mr. Chair.
on the mishandled bags. Welcome back, by the way, Mr. Letch.
Thank you so much.
My question is, do you track which employee mishandled those bags? And those who are not inside on the joke here, we have Representative Lilly, who's a good Delta employee who handles and keeps track of some of those bags. So, but we just wanted to know if perhaps we could track that, because I think he loses mine on purpose.
Is he the red line up there?
A lot of red.
Madam Chair, Representative Atkins, do I have to answer that question?
Please don't, sir.
Okay, I won't. No, we're down to the point where we're not too worried about individual employees. Everybody really is chipping in making this performance work. You can see the progression that we've made over the last couple of years. It's been pretty remarkable. We've seen a 70% drop in our mishandled baggage ratio. And I am proud to say, across all of these measures, the hub here in Minneapolis performs extraordinarily well, to the point where in 2012, Minneapolis was recognized as Delta's Hub of the Year. And when it comes to mishandled baggage ratio, a lot of the technology and the process that was developed in Minneapolis as a result of this merger has been scaled out to the system and has allowed this improvement to take place. So a lot of innovation, a lot of good work that goes on here in Minneapolis that we share and ultimately drives these results. Okay. Moving on, talking about our partners in Minnesota business, the key point here is that we partner at a corporate level, mid-level business, small-level businesses. We partner with thousands of companies in the state of Minnesota and provide various levels of support in some of our travel arrangements, whether it's here in the Twin Cities or across all of Minnesota. We take pride in the fact that we serve in various capacities, various forms. We serve more than 4,000 large and small businesses with agreements, travel agreements. And you can see on the far right over here, when it comes to international travel, where are our corporate customers who are traveling out of Minnesota? Where do they like to fly? Half of that volume is to Europe. About a third of it is to Asia and Pacific, and then we have other destinations. Some of them nonstop. Some of them, like South America, is not a nonstop out of Minneapolis-St. Paul. There's a requirement to connect either in Detroit or in Atlanta. So some of this is connecting, but a lot of this is nonstop traffic out of Minneapolis-St. Paul. I talked a little bit earlier about the size of our employment in the state.
Excuse me, just one moment. Representative Poppe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Lynch, could we go back one slide? I was just curious about the part that's Asia-Pacific. Do you know off the top of your head what percent of that is China?
Madam Chair, Representative Poppe, I don't know offhand. We can certainly get that information for you, but we have nonstop service out of Minneapolis-St. Paul directly to Tokyo, and then we have connecting service there into other parts of into other parts of Asia. I don't know what our China volume is, but we'll take a look and provide that info for you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Level of employment, I mentioned earlier, when you look at the main line, along with our affiliates and wholly owned subsidiaries, we have a little bit more than 12,000 employees in the state of Minnesota. That makes us the eighth largest private employer in the state, if you look at the far right, that bar graph that we have on the far right. This number will grow closer to 12,400, 12,500 when all of the pinnacle moves are made. That's the headquarters and then some of the pilot and flight attendant staffing adjustments that they will be making. On the left-hand side, the pie chart shows you roughly our $2 billion spend in the state of Minnesota and how that is apportioned out. And it's roughly about a third to our mainline operations, our big jets, roughly about a third in fuel expense, and then roughly about a third operating other parts of our business, including our regional carrier operations. So it's a pretty good mix of spend that we have in the state of Minnesota. Next page provides, this is intended, it's not an exhaustive list, but it's intended to give you an idea of some of the organizations on the left side of the page, some of the organizations that we have partnered with. And when I say partner, this is a combination of providing some cash support, maybe providing some barter travel, which is some travel vouchers to those organizations who may find that in some cases more valuable, particularly if their purpose is to move either their staff or their clients around the state, around the country, around the world. Or we provide volunteer hours. We have a very, very active employee base that is ready to spring into action anytime we have an opportunity to volunteer and support an organization in our community. The upper right-hand part of this page gives you a feel for the organizations where we have board representation. And then we also support the three of the Minnesota professional sports teams, the Minnesota Vikings, the Twins, and the Minnesota Wild. So we have a very diverse portfolio that keeps us well engaged in the community. And then the final page is really my punchline, which is that we support commerce in this state with a very broad network. We are one of the largest employers in the state of Minnesota with over $2 billion spent, as I indicated, more than 12,000 jobs. We are a responsible citizen of the community, and we support the community in very different ways, in a significant number of ways. And then in the end, we're very comfortable and we're very satisfied with the decisions that we have made to position this hub and to position our employees and to position this community for success going forward. Our operational reliability, the financial stability of the hub, the engagement in the community and the support that we provide the community is something that we're very proud of.
Thank you.
So with that, willing to take any questions.
Thank you very much. Members, do you have questions for the testifier? Representative Atkins, and do you want your chair back?
No, I think we finally got a chair that can run this meeting worthwhile, and it's kind of nice to have. But one of the coolest days that I remember in the recent months was when these fellows came and talked about Pinnacle moving their corporate headquarters here to Minnesota and the jobs that would follow And my understanding is that that's underway right now. But is there any other secrets that you care to share with us about other folks that are there? The real question is: are there other in terms of future expansion, additional jobs? You alluded, Mr. Lynch, to several hundred more. I didn't catch the number, and that's part of the reason I asked the question about when Pinnacle is fully up and running.
Sure.
But other things to look forward to in terms of Delta's growth and operations here in Minnesota.
Madam Chair, Representative Atkins. So we have roughly 200 to 300, 350 jobs that will be moving as part of the Pinnacle headquarters. I think I covered that before you were able to make it to this meeting. We also have some flight attendant and pilot positions that will be added to the Minneapolis base for Pinnacle. And this is a part of Pinnacle restructuring a little bit of their network. It doesn't mean additional destinations out of the Twin Cities, but the way that they are going to utilize crews makes it more advantageous to position them in Minneapolis, St. Paul versus in other bases. So we have that movement going on. Aside from that, there's always going to be some ups and downs as the business cycle hits us over time, but I think from my perspective, and you know, this can always change because you know there are some things outside of our control that may affect this, but I think we're at a really nice, stable, kind of steady state with some ups and downs along the way as demand may change, as we have some seasonality in our business, as the economy goes through cycles. No other real significant ups or downs that I can see in the near future.
Thank you. On that note, I might follow up with a question. How many regional carriers serve Minnesota currently, and how many of those are wholly owned by Delta currently?
Well, Madam Chair, committee members, we have one wholly owned and soon to be wholly owned subsidiary. It won't be until they emerge from bankruptcy, and that will be Pinnacle Airlines. Aside from that, we have agreements with seven other carriers who provide us services on contract. Compass Airlines has their headquarters here in Minneapolis, St. Paul, but they're not a wholly owned subsidiary. We just have contract for services with Compass. Of the seven regional carriers, I believe three operate out of Minneapolis.
SkyWest,
yeah. And then Shuttle America just came in as well. So, about half of those regional carriers in our portfolio operate out of Minneapolis, St. Paul, but only one soon to be wholly owned, and that is Pinnacle Airlines.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you. I have a series of questions for the chair. All right. That'd be funnier. I do have, and I might be the only one here interested in this, but I'm a former air freight guy, and I've got cargo questions. Could you just give us the 10,000-foot overview on Delta cargo operations out of Minneapolis, nationally, internationally,
sure,
whatever?
Madam Chair, Representative Hoppe, several years ago, we made a decision to retire a fleet of 747s that was designated or configured specifically for cargo. A very old fleet of airplanes, somewhat unreliable at the time, very expensive to maintain, and that does not in any way mean that we have pulled away from the cargo business. In fact, we continue to push very heavy to fill every bit of space on our passenger airplanes. It'll just be what we call belly cargo. Fill every bit of space that we have to continue to drive cargo revenue. And our cargo operations are performing well. Not only well relative to our expectations, but well relative to our competitive set in the industry. So there will continue to be a focus on cargo. We have a large presence here in Minneapolis, St. Paul. There's a large presence in Atlanta and Detroit and some of the other hubs as well. So the cargo footprint is essentially the same. We're just not putting it on cargo-designated airplanes. We're putting it into the bellies of airplanes and optimizing the use of our belly space.
Thank you. Additional questions for members? I have one other question for you. The Pinnacle Airlines was Mesaba Airlines was purchased by Pinnacle Airlines. Mesaba was headquartered in Eagan, and we did see a lot of job loss when that sale took place. Is there any effort or opportunity to target former Mesaba employees for these new jobs that are going to be coming into our community?
Yeah. Madam Chair, committee members, we expect of the 200 to 350 jobs that will be moving to the Twin Cities, we expect roughly half of those will be individuals who transfer from Memphis to the Twin Cities. That means we're going to have a large number that we're going to have to fill here locally. And we're excited about that because this is a very good job market, very talented, well-educated, you know, very very good work ethic, and we think that we can find what we need here in the Twin Cities and surrounding areas to satisfy the remainder of those positions that we're going to have at the headquarters. And so does that mean that former Masaba employees who may no longer be in the airline industry have an opportunity to come back into the industry? Absolutely.
Thank you. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I just want to mention that thank you for the job. You're never sure as a legislator if you're going to get reelected, and so you got to hope I still have a job there. It's kind of neat being here. I look out in the crowd, and I can see Ross Kramer, and he's a former 747 pilot, I believe, and pretty neat story, and he's down here doing good work. Working on people's issues, but maybe during if you could comment on the Res Center, and I don't know if you were able to mention that at all, and I know that's important to the folks up north and how great of a job they do. I don't, maybe Anzell needs a job up there, but no, it's been a...
If it's a union job, I'll take it.
Well, I'll let him answer that.
All right, Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Lilly. Timely question. I was at the Res Center last week. I had an opportunity to spend a day. By the way, the snow was still about a foot and a half deep up there, but I had an opportunity to spend a day in the facility holding town hall meetings with employees. I held 5 separate one-hour sessions with employees. There are roughly 450 employees at that center, which is up from a couple of years ago. They handle some of our best customers across the system. There are several employees, I think the number is somewhere between 50 and 60, who are now engaged in a work-from-home or work-at-home program. So they have the opportunity to do their reservations, agents' functions at home rather than come into the facility, which is important because they come from long distances. And with gas where it's at and time being very important to some of these people, it gives them an opportunity to work out of their home and save some money and be just as or maybe more efficient. The quality of the work that gets done up there is remarkable. I had an opportunity during my visit to do this process that we call double jacking, which is I plugged into a res agent's calls and listened to how these agents, a couple of different agents, service some of our customers. They're very well trained, they're very motivated, they're very capable people, which is why they serve many of our very good platinum and diamond customers. So we're really excited about the progress, about the level of performance, about the future of that center up on the range. Very high quality people.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members. I just think it's really something good to keep in mind, and I personally strongly feel is why we have such a strong business base in our state, is that the access that you've mentioned, the hubs, and that you can get places, and what that offers to businesses and to be able to get around. This is a Commerce Committee, and one of the things that's happened in the last year that I find interesting, he didn't mention that, maybe he doesn't want to, but I think it's really a neat idea that he showed you a bar chart, and a lot of it's employee expenses and buying equipment. But in the airline, obviously, a big expense is fuel. So maybe you want to mention what they've done as a business decided to do. And I think it's really fascinating. Being a Commerce Committee, I think it's might be an interesting study for us to hear about.
Sure. Madam Chair, Representative Lilly. So fuel is our largest single expense. Part of that fuel expense is the cost to refine crude oil into airplane gas. We call it Jet A fuel. So rather than be subjected to the volatility in the refining industry business and having to pay, in some cases, some pretty handsome profits to some of the refiners, we decided to take matters into our own hands. So last year we purchased a refinery and engaged in some vertical integration. It is a company called Monroe Engineering. It is a wholly owned subsidiary of Delta Airlines. We hired roughly 400 jobs. It's out in the Philadelphia area, out in Pennsylvania. And that facility is capable of providing Delta Airlines 80% of its domestic fuel consumption on a daily basis. It's a facility that can refine about 185,000 barrels of oil a day. Not all of that is refined into Jet A fuel. So roughly a third of that, maybe a little bit less than a third of that, is we can make into Jet A fuel and deliver to our airplanes. The remaining petroleum byproducts we capture and then we barter with other oil companies for additional Jet A fuel at other locations around the United States. So effectively, we take 185,000 barrels of fuel a day, of oil a day, and convert it into Jet A for our operations. That allows us to control better the cost of fuel, because a large component of fuel cost growth over the last several years has been in the refining cost. Well, we've just now taken control of that for 80% of our domestic consumption. So it's a refinery that is now up and running, and we're excited about what it's going to mean to the future stability of our airline and being able to manage through some of these volatile fuel cycles.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Members, I see I've got two other folks on the list for questions, and then we looks like we'll have to move on to our next bill. Representative Ansel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to clearly indicate that the people of the Iron Range appreciate the employment opportunities, appreciate your being a good corporate citizen there on the range, and we thank you for the opportunity to have good jobs.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to come in and give us this presentation. That was very interesting. And with that, we can move on to our next bill.
Can I make one last comment?
Mr. Lesh,
and this is an offer to anyone who sits on this committee or otherwise. We're very open to opening our facilities to any of you if you are interested in spending some time when you have time to come out and tour our operation. We're happy to show you control center operations. I'd rather not have to show you de-ice operations this time of year. We can hold that off until next year because I'm hopeful that'll go away. But control center operations, bag room operations, walk the ramp, get a feel for how our employees run this place. I think you'd be very impressed. So it's an offer that I want to extend to all of you. If there's any interest in doing that, we're open to doing that. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
While we change seats here, maybe we could ask Representative Schoen to move the minutes from April 3rd, and we can get those approved. So moved. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed?
Thanks. I'm
minutes are approved.
Madam Chair, things were going well. Don't
give up power. Hang on to that gavel.
Don't forget your
name.
Yeah. What's the matter with you?
I'll be back.
Yeah. Next up before us, and thank you, by the way, Representative Halverson. I had a bill up in another committee. Actually, so did Representative Hillstrom, who's got this bill in committee, and it was very kind of you to assume the chair while we were gone. House File 1052, Representative Hillstrom will move House File 1052. Just so we're clear, members, this is an issue that has arisen over a number of sessions. It's one that I suspect that a number of newer members and even some members who've been around for a little while may not be completely familiar with, but it's a very serious one, and it's one where, quite frankly, both sides are very well represented and have strong cases that they that they're able to make. And I invited him to present this bill for us because it's an issue that I don't expect is going to disappear anytime soon, and I think it's one that's very valuable for members to kind of know the ins and outs of. With that, Representative Hillstrom, we will turn it over to you. I expect to go till about with the proponents of the bill, and I assume that there's some till about 5:10. And then turn, assuming that there's some opposition to the bill, to do the remaining 20 minutes. I do want to assure members that we will be done at the end of the committee time, which is at 5:30, as I know there's several members with other obligations. So with that, Representative Hillstrom, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And first, let me say thank you for agreeing to have an informational hearing for us here today. Members, we're here to talk about We're not here to talk about what you see on HGTV, Home and Garden TV. Licensed interior design, which is a segment of the interior design profession, is a serious matter because it affects the health and safety and welfare of citizens of Minnesota. This bill will not affect kitchen and bath or residential interior design, cabinet shops or appliance or lighting retailers, no matter the size of the firm, as their practice is currently exempt under the Minnesota State Building Code and will remain so after this legislation passes. And I want to make it clear on page 2 of the bill, a section I've highlighted makes that very clear. This bill will not restrict architects from practicing licensed interior design. I have with me Rachel Schlossler-Lynn and Bill Hickey, who will really further elaborate on this issue of licensed interior designs.
Thank you, Chair Atkins, for having us today. My name is Rochelle Schlossler-Lynn. I am a certified interior designer in the state of Minnesota. I also am an adjunct faculty member at the University of Minnesota in the College of Design. And I served on the licensing board for 8 years. And the licensing board is the AELSLAGID, which is the architects, engineers, land surveyors, architects, engineers, land surveyors, landscape architects, geoscientists, and certified interior designers. So thank you for taking the time to let us come here today. I want to tell you a little bit about the history and rationale for the legislation. Minnesota has had a title act for 21 years. A title act regulates one's title. Our title is certified interior designer versus a practice act which regulates what a certified interior designer does or a licensed interior designer does. When this certification was adopted 21 years ago, this approach made sense as a starting point for regulation of the profession. The profession is complex and continues to evolve, and the Title Act with the provision to stamp and seal drawings, which is what we currently have. So we have a Title Act certified interior designer with stamp and seal privileges. This is a confusing hybrid and is not doing its job in differentiating those who are qualified to practice the full scope of interior design. Currently, under existing law, the health, safety, and welfare of the public is at risk, and this Practice Act will provide the clarity that is needed. The purpose of this legislation is to protect the public through the board's enforcement power. Certified interior designers cannot be found in violation of unregulated practice because only the title certified interior designer is regulated. Building code officials are overburdened and the current language is vague, creating confusion as to who is qualified to design public commercial spaces such as schools, senior living facilities, office environments, restaurants, etc. As with most professions, interior design education, practice, and examination have evolved to respond to a profession that has expanded from a practice focused on art and decoration to a skill and knowledge base that encompasses a significantly broader spectrum of design. Interior design today addresses all aspects of interior environments and the experience, health, safety, and well-being of the occupants within those environments. The accredited education, experience, and examination provides interior designers eligible for licensure with specific knowledge, competency, and expertise to protect the health, safety, and welfare within the built environment. Much of this curriculum is not addressed in the educational curriculum of any other design profession. Licensed interior design is a unique profession. Ever since the passage of the certified interior design legislation in 1992, there have been advancements made relative to the practice of interior design in the state of Minnesota. In 2011, the licensing board strengthened the education, experience, and examination requirements in the Minnesota rules. A 4-year degree from an accredited interior design program, a 2-year internship, and the passage of a 2-day rigorous exam called the NCIDQ exam is now required for certified interior designers in the state of Minnesota. On another note, the education, the interior design education accreditation, and the national exam, the NCIDQ exam, have been in place since the 1970s. Certified interior designers affect the health, safety, and welfare of the people in the environments that we design. Interior designers equipped with this background are responsible for designing all aspects of the interior environments, and the following are a couple of examples of how those qualified for CID or licensed interior design affect the health, safety, and welfare. For example, 20% of the deaths in nursing homes are attributed to falls. Interior designers specify materials that provide appropriate levels of slip resistance and reduce the amount of glare, which in the end prevents falls. Children miss school days, not only because they think they have a tummy ache, but they also miss school days because of bad indoor air quality. So the bad indoor air quality comes from the toxins and VOCs, volatile organic compounds, that are emitted from carpeting, paints, adhesives, wall coverings, and cabinetry, which causes them to have headaches or be dizzy, and they can't concentrate at school. The National Fire Protection Association, the NFPA, documentation reveals that ignition of interior materials was responsible for an average of 8,500 fires per year, causing 23 deaths and 330 injuries to civilians, and almost $400 million in direct property damage. Certified interior designers and, in the future, licensed interior designers apply building, fire, and life safety codes to specifications of materials, furnishings, upholstery, window and wall treatments, etc., which would otherwise contribute to the fuel load of the space. From an environmental standpoint, in addition to the indoor air quality impact that we have on the interior environments and quality of human health, we also contribute towards the waste that goes to the landfill. 40% of the waste that we find in the landfill is attributed to building construction. A majority of building construction comes from interior renovations. And so, as qualified interior designers, we apply our sustainability standards and green design to reduce our carbon footprint. Certified interior designers and licensed interior designers in the future are also required to carry liability insurance. We have been contacted by the Dean of the College of Design here at the University of Minnesota. He provided a letter in the packet, and I just want to call out one of his statements. The College of Design includes the interior design program, which is accredited architecture program, landscape architecture, and many other departments. Dean Tom Fisher is the dean of the College of Design, and I just want to call this out. He writes, "I write to express my frustration at the ongoing and now annual confrontation between architects and designers over the question of licensure. My frustration has to do with how this flies in the face of what we teach our students, which is that architects and interior designers need to work together in close partnership in order to assure the best result for our clients. The frustration also stems from what seems obvious, which is that both fields deal with life safety issues in buildings, and both have a dramatic impact on the lives of inhabitants." And we have several students here today in the gallery as well, so we do think about their future as well. I want to just summarize a few points from our bill. The requirements of this bill pertain to licensed interior designers and not the broader interior design profession. This bill will not put any practitioner out of business. If you are currently not required to sign documents to pull a building permit, then you will not be required to sign those drawings in the future. And as an example, I wanted to call out the letter that is included from Lowe's in your packet, where it talks about the bill has the potential to curtail services Lowe's currently makes available to customers, and the added negative consequence of unreasonably limiting the offerings of qualified small business. Many of these businesses rely on Lowe's for products to fulfill customer orders. And if you refer to page 2 of our bill, and you look specifically at lines 2.12 through 2.18, you can see that we have called out specifically that an employee or owner of a retail establishment providing consultation in the furtherance of a retail sale or prospective retail sale regarding interior finishes, furnishings, or cabinetry on behalf of the retail establishment is not required to become a licensed interior designer. A person who provides services or assistance in selection, sale, lease, or supply of services, materials, etc., is not required to be a licensed interior designer. So retail stores that sell product that we specify and install in our projects are not required to, they're not required to do anything different than what they currently do, and the same is true for the interior designers that work in those establishments. Certified interior designers and other licensed design professionals design non-exempt building types such as schools, hotels, corporate offices, pursuant to the Minnesota State Building Code, non-exempt building types such as single-family homes, residences, and small office spaces can be designed by any designer, decorator, and even yourselves. If you are currently not required to sign your documents to pull a permit, the building permit, then you will not be required to do that once this legislation passes. I also want to call out that the students that are attending and graduating from programs, interior design programs, that have less than a bachelor's degree as their final degree, professional degree, are also allowed to practice in the non-exempt spaces, and or they can also practice under the direct supervision of a licensed or certified professional. So they have a an employment path in front of them. There is an overlap of the professions, as we see on the licensing board. There's an overlap between interior design and architecture. There's an overlap between architecture and engineering, interior design and architecture, architecture and landscape architecture. It's the nature of the way that we design space that we collaborate, and we do have an overlap in our work that we do. Today we are here to talk about the uniqueness and the specialty of the licensed interior designer. My closing statement is that the existing Certified Interior Design Title Act is inadequate to prevent or remedy any harm to the public. The profession of interior design has evolved in response to our changing world, and the existing Certified Interior Design language is confusing to the code officials. We currently have 705 certified interior designers in Minnesota, and the majority of them are interior designers by education. There are 27 jurisdictions that have recognized the critical nature of this profession and have some form of regulation, plus 7 Canadian provinces. 10 of those require stamp and seal for building permits, and 5 of the 10 are practice acts. This bill is not intended to license the entire interior design profession. You may hear opposition today that states that interior design does not threaten the health, safety, and welfare. However, legislators in Minnesota determined 21 years ago that those interior designers who meet the education, testing, and experience requirements to practice in a full scope of work in a complex commercial environment do, in fact, affect the health, safety, and welfare of the public, and therefore we have the certified interior design position that we currently have. I would like to thank you for your time today. I realize that we're not taking a vote. However, I would ask for your support of the interior design legislation that you are looking, that you're reviewing, and we look forward to this ongoing dialogue. And with that, I'd like to introduce Bill Hickey.
Thank you, Ms. Schessler. And, and with that, we'll go to Mr. Hickey. We've got, and I think we've got a question. Is that for Ms. Schessler?
I'll wait.
Okay, thank you, Representative Dean. Mr. Hickey.
My name's Bill Hickey. I'm a design firm owner. I'm a registered architect, and I'm a certified interior designer. I'm also an AIA member. I think one of the things you probably will hear about today is the AIA's national policy opposing licensure of all professions other than architecture and engineering. Just as not all architects are AIA members, not all AIA members support this national position. It's a turf issue, and it picks fights with our best friends. Over the years that we've been working on this bill, we've had a lot of strategic discussions with the AIA and other groups. We're not able to reach agreement, but we have listened to concerns. We have modified language to address those concerns, and we believe we've improved the bill as a result. As a firm owner, I hire and depend upon certified interior designers to design spaces. The proposed licensure is important because it places the full responsibility for the health, safety, and welfare of the public, of the occupants of those commercial interior spaces, on the designers. It is in the best interest of the public to do so. The examination of the bill, you'll find that the scope of responsibilities of a licensed interior design is clearly defined. It is not redefining the practice of interior design. It takes a step forward. It clarifies the role of the licensed interior designer and differentiates the full scope of practice from those not qualified to practice in complex environments regarding health, safety, and welfare. As an architect, I do not feel that threatened in any way that I'm going to lose any business as a result of this, or any of my peers going to lose any by the advent of a licensed interior design regulation. You may also hear, oh, they just want to be architects. Okay. That is very much not the case. The professions are distinct. They're allied, but distinct, and have the same sort of partnership as with architecture and interior design as architecture and structural engineering. They are mutually supportive in the design profession. I'm here as an architect supporting this legislation because when I got my own license many, many years ago, I took an oath to the people of Minnesota that I would work to promote their health, safety, and welfare. This bill does that. It does not promote one profession over another, nor does it hold down others who choose different paths. But this is in the best interest of the health, safety, and welfare of the people of Minnesota. I ask for your support. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hickey. And now we'll go to Lee McGrath. And we have a question. I'm sorry, Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quick question regarding, you had mentioned the issue of accreditation and internship and then exam. You know, for those who don't know, I'm trained as an architect. I can't say I'm an architect because I don't have my license. Could you speak to the rigors of accreditation and what that process actually is for the schools in determining an individual? And then can you also speak about a two-year internship? Because I know in the architecture profession, it's 3 years if you do everything right. The average time is about 5 or 6 for most people. Can you just speak to those a little bit?
Right.
Okay, Ms. Oshlesser.
Sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. The accreditation process for a four-year interior design program is quite rigorous, and there are about 10 or 11 points, maybe it's 16 actually, 16 points that the interior design program is reviewed on by an accreditation body. So we have a national accreditation body. It's very similar to the accreditation body that they have for architecture and landscape architecture and some of the other disciplines. Every 6 years they review the accredited programs, and you go through a rigorous review of how the coursework that's being taught in the university program aligns with the accreditation 16 points that they have that you need to demonstrate. So it's everything from specific points in the design process, your knowledge and experience in applying building codes to your design solutions, understanding sustainability solutions. It's very comprehensive, and it's not just knowing the subject matter, but also demonstrating that you can apply that to actual design solutions. So that process happens every 4 years. It takes about the process is a team of people come and they physically review all of the student work at that time, and they write a report and decide whether that program can continue to be accredited or not. So if that answers that.
Representative Dean.
Just a quick follow-up. So most schools get a six-year accreditation?
It's a six-year. Your accreditation is valid for 6 years.
Okay.
And then you go through the process again.
So Madam Chair and Ms. Lynn, so it's quite possible that a school could graduate two classes that really haven't met the requirements because of the gap between those two.
Ms. Lynn?
No, that's not possible. The program is accredited for the entire period of time. So the program is accredited for the entire 6 year period. Typically what will happen once you have your review, if something comes up that they are looking for additional information, they will give you an extension for time to reply to any concerns or requests that they have in that program. It's not a student that is in that program, and if the accreditation is put on probation or something like that, the student would still have that accreditation when they graduate.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've been intimately involved with the architecture profession, and one of the biggest concerns is, are students able to get through a program that doesn't really meet the accreditation requirements. And one of my biggest concerns as I hear this is if a program is 4 years and accreditation is a 6-year period, you could actually graduate 2 or possibly even 3 classes before the reaccreditation of the program might actually find a deficiency in that. And I'm not going to ask you to cite any statistics of how many schools have been found not to have their accreditation, maximum accreditation, or if schools have actually had their accreditation pulled. But and this is probably, you know, a different discussion relative to this, but the ability of students to graduate from a school that is not meeting, the school would still be accredited for those students, but the qualifications of the education that the student might get could be deficient.
Ms. Lynn?
What I would say is I am more than happy to provide additional information as to exactly how that process works. I actually just had a meeting with the CETA accredited executive director over the weekend. And so I would be more than happy to provide additional information on that specifics to assure you that so that we can address those concerns. I think it'd be better if I could provide actual factual information. And
thank you for that. That would be very helpful. And we do have 6 other testifiers, 3 that aren't on the list. But I think that's very interesting information. Having served on the old licensing board, this is not an unusual question or circumstance. So if you could then, when you share that information with Representative, copy all of us on that, I'd appreciate that information. I'm sure the rest of the members would. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to make it really clear that every single program has a number of years that they're accredited by, and to imply that students would graduate during longer accreditation is no different than how frequently a law school gets accredited or how frequently a medical school gets accredited. Every single program has an accreditation timeline, and I just don't think that I'll just leave that.
Well, it's an interesting discussion, so we ought to look forward to hearing the information. And I would like then, Representative, was that it, your follow-up?
No,
and you're through? Okay, then we do have Lee McGrath, followed by Ann Voda. If the Ann Voda would be on board, come down. And thank you very much, testifiers. Mr. McGrath, welcome to the committee. Please state your name.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Lee McGrath. I'm the legislative counsel for the Institute for Justice. The Institute for Justice is a public interest law firm that is headquartered in Arlington, Virginia. We have state chapters across the country, including the state of Minnesota, where I'm the executive director, also the executive director of the state chapter. We also run a clinic at the University of Chicago Law School. The Institute, and thank you for the opportunity to testify against this unneeded legislation. The Institute for Justice has lobbied and litigated in 60 economic liberty cases against anti-competitive regulations that are often enacted under the pretext of health and safety and consumer protection. Specifically in the area of occupational licensing, we have lobbied and sued 3 state boards over licensing of interior designers, 10 cosmetology boards on behalf of hair braiders, makeup artists, and threaders, and most recently the Louisiana State Board of Embalmers and Funeral Directors on behalf of monks. You cannot get clients better than monks, and we were pleased that the Fifth Circuit upheld a ruling by the Federal District Court that struck down the requirement that monks become licensed funeral directors. Additionally, we have published 4 pieces of original research against the occupational regulation of interior designers and are pleased that only 3 states currently license interior designers, and we are working to eliminate we hope to eliminate the licensing in those 3 states, as well as the District of Columbia. Madam Chairman, members of the committee, House File 1052 is a major step backwards. It is contrary to good public policy from an economic perspective, as well as a social justice perspective. because it establishes a preference for licensure over the much preferred means of occupational regulation, which is certification. From an economics perspective, certification is better than occupational licensing for three reasons. First, certification has benefits over for workers. Certification does not fence out workers or cause the type of problems and distortions in labor markets that licensing does. Licensing may cause workers to lose the opportunity to move into the middle class because of expensive barriers to entry. Licensing further reduces the ability of workers to move across state lines and engage in work that is most beneficial to them and to society. Certification of practitioners does not have these negative features. Additionally, the work of Professor Kleiner, Kruger, and Maas show that that occupational licensing shrinks the availability of jobs. I know job creation is important at all times, but particularly in these times, and licensing regulations cause unemployment to go up by about 0.5% to 1%. In Minnesota, with our current level of licensing, that equals about 15,000 jobs that don't exist because of excessive and overburdensome occupational licensing. Secondly, certification is better for consumers than occupational licensing. Similar to licensing, certification sends us an important signal to consumers about who has met the government's requirement. However, certification does not reduce competition, and it does not cause prices to increase the way licensing does and the way the advocates for licensing often want. It gives consumers more choices for the kinds of services they need. In fact, Kleiner's research shows that the presence of occupational licensing shrinks the available pool of labor, causing prices to go up by about 15% and causing Minnesota consumers to pay a premium in excess of $3.5 billion a year with no clear consumer protection benefits. Thirdly, certification is better for state legislators than occupational licensing. It reduces the unnecessary and often excessive lobbying by trade associations trying to convince legislators to enact licensing regimes under unproven assumptions of protecting the public. Often, lobbyists claim that licensing is needed to screen out frauds and incompetence. Unfortunately, there is little to no evidence at all that incompetent and fraud is screened out through occupational licensing more than what occurs in competitive labor markets. This is because this failure to weed out incompetence and fraud, Madam Chairman, is caused by a number of factors, and one of them is at the heart of this bill. It is the common technique of including a grandfathering clause for all existing workers. The premise of the advocates of this bill is something dangerous is happening in Minnesota.
And Mr. McGrath, excuse me, I don't mean to interrupt, but I'm going to have to ask you to wrap up and also let the members know we do have a copy of your testimony in our packet so
Very
that
good.
We won't miss. But if you could, we're running a little
Absolutely, Madam
long.
Chairman. So the basic problem, the fallacy of the of licensing, and in this bill in particular, is a grandfathering clause. Those people who are causing the problem, those current practitioners, are grandfathered in and given a license. At the very minimum, Madam Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, I encourage the committee, if they are going to go forward, to delete the grandfathering clause in Section 2. And finally, Madam Chairman, let me just say that licensing boards are an ineffective way to screen out frauds and incompetence because they don't do it. It is very rare to revoke a license, and this is done for two reasons. One is collegiality, and the second is due process concerns. It is very expensive to take a piece of constitutionally protected property away from people, and and therefore it is rarely done. And I am sure you have heard executive directors of licensing boards say things like, we would rather work with licensees to fix problems than to revoke their license. This is at the heart of a failed institution. I encourage the committee to table this bill this year and next year, and I'm happy to answer any questions about House File 1052.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. Any questions from members? I see none. I thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And then we do have Ann Boda and Eric West, if you'd both come together to the table. Hello. Welcome.
Hello.
And go ahead, state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, representatives. My name is Ann Boda. I'm a licensed architect, and I'm a certified interior designer. I'm principal owner of Benz Thompson Rito Architects in downtown Minneapolis, and I am president of AI Minnesota, representing 2,200 members. 70% of architects in Minnesota are AIA Minnesota members. In Minnesota, you license architects to design buildings and coordinate all the complex systems which have to function together to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the public and buildings. To be licensed to accept this responsibility, we must achieve a 6-year accredited master's degree in Minnesota, a 3-year minimum internship under the supervision of a licensed architect, and we must pass a 7-part exam on building systems, codes, and architectural practice, and as well as 24 credits every biennium for ongoing continuing education. We believe that passing the interior design licensing bill will not improve protections to the health, safety, and of building occupants, and will, in fact, reduce them. If this bill passes, it would allow interior designers to affect existing building systems in a very real way to practice architecture without the necessary education, training, and testing required to protect the health, safety, and welfare of occupants inside buildings. The life safety functions of buildings and the systems operating within them are complicated and can't be separated simply into the interior part and the exterior part. For example, the mechanical and electrical systems, the fire ratings, the ceilings and corridors, the smoke enclosures, the doors and partitions, the number of occupants are all designed and coordinated to function together as a whole. Only licensed architects are qualified by education, examination, and experience to oversee and coordinate the specialized disciplines that do indeed come together and are required to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the occupants. This bill will essentially provide a new path to licensure that overlaps significantly with architecture without the similar required training and experience. There has been no demonstrated need to license architects or to license interior design activities in Minnesota. Since 1992, when certification of interior design was passed, the certification of qualified interior designers has worked well. Current state law is adequate to prevent or remedy any harm to the public from the activities of interior designers. The board, which licenses architects and certifies interior designers, does have the authority to enforce interior design activities. Regarding selection of interior finishes, these are already well regulated. Licensing of interior designers is not going to change those regulations. The purpose of licensing is to protect the health, safety, and welfare of the public. This bill does not do that. In fact, it reduces those protections. We urge you not to support it.
Thank you for your testimony. Go ahead, Mr. West.
Madam Chair, representatives, my name is Eric West. I am with the co-chair of the AIA Government Affairs Committee. And we thought it might be helpful to just illustrate the complexity of building in a brief example, if you will. Taking a warehouse and converting it into an office or converting it to a restaurant, which happens a lot. When we do this, a lot of things change. The number of people using that building change from 7 or 8 in a warehouse example to maybe 100 in an office. When that happens, we have to understand the exiting requirements, which impacts the number of doors, the size of the doors, the location of those doors. We have to understand the fire rating, the assemblies that get those occupants from the back of the building to that exit, how far they can go. They separate uses like storage rooms, kitchens that are volatile and could be dangerous from spaces where people are working. We also have to understand the complexity of all the systems, how they work together. Systems for smoke control, sprinklers, air pressure, how that impacts moisture, movement of air through all of these different occupancies. It's fairly complex. And building systems, when we change those, some of those new uses also change the way the building operates. Injecting a lot of moisture from a kitchen or a lot of humidity for an office space might change the way the exterior wall performs. The original design may have been for that simple warehouse building, and now putting up some gypsum in front of that may, without proper insulation and everything else, may create a mold problem, which would impact the health of those occupants. Buildings are very complex organisms, and that's why we believe that the high level of rigor, education, experience that's required for a licensed architect should remain. We take the safety, life safety, health, welfare of people very, very seriously. We wouldn't challenge this. We do believe that that is being met by current law.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your testimony. And members, are there any questions? Yes, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On line 2.30 of the bill, it starts, the practice of licensed interior design does not include any of the following: load-bearing walls, fire-rated interior shafts, multi-sensory building, interior exits, smoke control system, sprinkler and fire alarm system, ventilation system, elevators, escalators. Isn't that what you just testified was going to be regulated? That's specifically not included in this bill.
Madam Chair, Ms. Voda. There are several exclusions new in this version of the bill. There are also several exclusions to the exclusions, which make it complicated and even more confusing as far as who is responsible for what.
Well, Representative Hillstrom, follow up.
Thank you
to both of you testifiers. This is a subject that will continue, so it's, the dialogue is helpful. So I appreciate you coming. Thank you very much. And we have now Galen Jurgensen, Caitlin Brands, and Taryn Zacher. Am I butchering those names? I hope not. Hello, welcome. Yeah, don't be afraid.
Just <I'm> afraid.
These are some students, I believe. Are
yes.
Are you not? All right, good. This is great. So, well, welcome to the committee. And whoever wants to start can begin by saying their name into the microphone for the tape and proceed.
Right. Thank you, Madam Chairman, and all the representatives for the chance to voice our concerns about this bill. I'm Caitlin Brands. I am a first-year interior design student at Alexandria Technical Institute, which is a two-year program. I want to express my concerns about this bill and provide information on my position opposing the bill. I previously did attend a four-year college that was CIDA accredited, and then I transferred to Alexandria Technical Community College. Why I chose Alexandria Technical Community College was they had a design connection board. This board exposes us to networking abilities, to the organizations of ASID, NKBA, IIDA, and we have president chapters in this board, and that was one reason why I chose Alexandria Technical Community College. Another one was the direct access we got as students from our professors regarding the industry, project requirements, expectations, and feedback. These two characteristics that I found at Alexandria Technical Institute, I did not get at the four-year accredited, CETA accredited school. They did not provide this for us. Another thing is when I went to Alexandria for the college for a day and to speak to my professors, I finally found that interior design was the career I wanted to be in, that it was going to be my passion. It was my dream. And I feel like this bill, if it is passed, isn't going to allow others to find this passion of interior design. And also I want to make a comment that even if this bill is passed, even though some of the areas of interior design are going to be excluded and some are still going to be included with this bill, the ones that are not included are the ones that I want my career path to be in. So those are going to be eliminated from my career path, from my dream, and from my passion. So I just wanted to make that note, and thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And to the next testifier, please.
Hi, Madam Chairman, Representatives. My name is Taryn Zocker, and I am a second-year student at Alexandria Technical and Community College. And my concerns with this bill also go along, as you can tell, with the second-year or the two-year to four-year requirements. And in our program, we jump in, dive in right away, 2 years in and out. And for, I would guess, my concerns is why is a two-year degree not sufficient, but a four-year is, when I have taken classes, I will be graduating in May, and a big part of our program is sustainability, ADA compliant. We are learning all of that. We are learning all of the same curriculums, the specified design classes. We do them at a faster pace, and I think a benefit of our program, because our industry and our profession is a service profession. We interact with people on a daily basis once we get out into the field. And by taking the steps and being proactive about this and going on the fast track of the two-year degree, we put ourselves out there in the industry faster. We gain the knowledge faster. And so I might have completed my degree and my internship, and I'm looking for a job, and someone who has just completed their four-year degree is competing for the same job. So if I was to go in there to an employee and say, yes, I have a two-year degree, but I've also been in the industry for 3 years, and this person has come in with just their four-year degree and internship, I personally would think that the person with the 3 years of experience would have the upper hand, seeing that they've, you know, put in time and have actually experienced, you know, that client interaction, the dealing with dealers and reps and all of that, where someone has only just gone through their schooling. And so that is also another benefit of our two-year program. We have the privilege to work with pretend life clients, where we go to a person's house or we meet with a business and we draft up plans and specify finishes and give them new layouts. It's not just, here's your pretend client and give me all of your work. It's, we've had that one-on-one interaction. Mm-hmm. And so that's something I would just like you guys to take into consideration. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Jurgensen?
Yes.
To you.
Hi, my name is Galen Jurgensen, and I'm currently instructing at the Alexandria Technical Community College. I am back after retirement of 4 years, so I'm just filling in for a semester. I would like to tell you a little bit of myself. I'm a graduate of a Votech college or institute from 1971. In the ensuing years, I have been practicing interior designer. I am a professional member of ASID, the American Society of Interior Designer. I am an NKBA member. I am a certified kitchen bath designer. I am a certified kitchen and educator for both disciplines. And I am an NCIDQ, the National Council for Interior Design Qualification Certificate Holder number 11046. And I have been on the board of NCIDQ, and I have seen what the requirements are for passage of a rigorous exam. I would like to just indicate the fact that, first of all, having taught in the Minsky system, I did teach from when we converted from a district-held college, or VOTEC, to a system called Minsky. Minsky currently has no four-year degree-granting institute in its system to graduate anyone who would qualify for any of the requirements to become a licensed interior designer. I have been around with this action since 19, well, for 30 years. Let's not do the math. I was actually involved in MIDLAC, the Minnesota Interior Design Legislative Action Committee, monitoring so that my students would not be put out of in a position where they would not be able to work. In the ensuing years, I've watched the process work. I'm still involved with it, and I will be for a long time. But besides the fact that there is no four-year degree-granting institution besides the university, it seems to behoove the fact that you'd have to think in terms of any kind of licensing that would not be able to provide an adequate number of places to do an internship under a qualified person who not only has come from a four-year degree that's CITER accredited, but they also would have to be able to have passed the NCIDQ and have been in place to honor an internship. There's not enough numbers, and if you're going to require that, you need to have more than just one degree-granting institute in the position to do that. Some of the other things that I've seen in my years of education is right now there is no outcry for further protection. It is adequately and beautifully covered with ADA and all of the international building codes and all of the aspects of how you can pull a permit to do any business, and it has been so noted that it is a heavily regulated industry, and one more bureaucratic layer will not, of unnecessary licensing, will not add any benefits to the citizens of Minnesota. Kind of in closing, I would like to say one thing that is presently available, and I've heard that it's been discounted, and that's unfortunate because in the original certification, there is a stamp and seal provision that would require anybody who has an infraction that there is a disciplinary action that can happen, and it is in place right now. There are very few, if any, infractions other than maybe not paying their dues, maybe being delinquent on certain kinds of taxes and things of that nature, but there is the stamp and seal provision can be revoked. And I think you need to understand that Minnesota has been very diligent about watching for that, and it's in place, and there is no reason for any additional licensing that, for all of the things that have been said before, do not need to be reiterated at this particular point. I thank the Honorable Chair, Madam Chair, and the representatives for listening, and we appreciate your concern and the things that we may ask, or you may ask of me now if you have any questions.
Well, thank you for your testimony. I appreciate you coming down. And are there any questions from the members? Seeing none, I would go to
thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Hillstrom, you are going to get the last word here on your bill.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. I just want to make it really clear that this issue has been around for a while, and it's not going to go away. And the interior design folks are asking for this licensure. You heard Rachel's talking about who this legislation really does impact and who it doesn't. The requirements of this bill pertain to licensed interior designers and not the broader interior design profession. It's been recognized for over 21 years in Minnesota that interior design of non-exempt spaces does affect the health, safety, and welfare of the public, and it's time to change it to a licensed practice. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate having an informational hearing on the bill, and I'm sure we haven't heard the end of it. So thank you again, and with that, we are adjourned.